New York, this is Democracy Now!
Palestinians in Gaza are enduring horrifying levels of hunger and suffering. This is the highest number of people facing catastrophic hunger ever recorded.
A new UN-backed report finds famine is imminent in northern Gaza, and Israeli troops launch a fourth major raid on Shifa Hospital, where tens of thousands have been seeking shelter. We'll go to Ramallah to speak with Palestinian physician and politician Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. Then at least 12 are killed in Haiti as violence and turmoil continue. We'll talk to the former U.S. Special Envoy for Haiti, Ambassador Dan Foote. He resigned from his post in 2021, citing the Biden administration's, quote, inhumane treatment of Haitian asylum seekers and U.S. meddling in Haitian politics. Then, as Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump calls immigrants animals again, a new film called Unseen hopes to reframe the narrative entirely. It profiles a blind, undocumented social work student named Pedro.
The intersectionality between being undocumented and having a disability, it plays a lot of stress and anxiety into you. I decided to study social work. I wanted to help people. I wanted to give an opportunity for those that they didn't have an opportunity.
We'll speak with the film's director, Seth Hernandez. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Famine is imminent in northern Gaza, according to a UN-backed report published Monday. Michael Fakhry, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, said the U.S. is, quote, complicit in the starvation of the Palestinian people in Gaza, and urged the Biden administration to call for a ceasefire and stop sending weapons and money to Israel. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and UNRWA Chief Philippe Lazzarini also blasted what they called the man-made hunger crisis Monday. This is EU's top diplomat, Josep Borrell.
This famine is not a natural disaster. It's not a flood. It's not a earthquake. It's entirely man-made. I'm coming from Washington, and I dare to say, well, yes, Israel is provoking famine.
Borrell added, quote, before the war, Gaza was the greatest open-air prison. Today, it's the greatest open-air graveyard, he said. The European Union Monday approved sanctions against violent Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank and against Hamas. The White House says President Biden told Benjamin Netanyahu Israel should not invade Rafah during a Monday phone call, as the Israeli prime minister reportedly agreed to send a team of Israeli officials to Washington to discuss an alternative approach. But the Palestinian foreign ministry says Israel has already begun its large-scale attack on Rafah without announcing it, as Israeli forces escalate their bombardment of the once so-called safe zone, where some 1.5 million Palestinians have taken shelter. Earlier today, Israeli strikes killed at least 14 people in Rafah and injured dozens of others.
We're in Ramadan. People have suhoor to prepare for the fast, but we're having suhoor over body remains, blood and martyrs. There's U.S. support, European support, and support of the whole world to Israel. They support them with weapons and planes, with continuing planes. They mock us and send 4 or 5 airdrops just to save face.
Close to 32,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israel since October 7th, according to the latest official numbers. 74,000 others have been injured. The police general tasked with coordinating the entry of aid trucks into northern Gaza was killed by Israeli forces during their raid on the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza City on Monday. Faik Mabhou recently helped secure the arrival of food aid for two nights in a row after weeks of Israeli blockade. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera journalist Ismail Al-Ghul, who was arrested and beaten during the Al-Shifa raid, was released after 12 hours of detention. While in Israeli custody, Al-Ghul said he and other journalists were forced to strip naked, lie on their stomachs for hours in the cold while blindfolded with their hands tied. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces arrested journalist Rula Hassanein and raided her home overnight. She has a nine-month-old baby she was forced to leave behind despite still breastfeeding. In related news, a 26-year-old Palestinian Bedouin detained in an Israeli prison died over the weekend amidst reports of rampant abuse and medical neglect in Israeli jails. Juma Abu Ghanima is at least the 13th person to die from mistreatment in an Israeli prison since October 7th. In Haiti, at least a dozen people were killed as armed groups attacked two upscale neighborhoods in the capital, Port-au-Prince, Monday. The communities of La Boule and Thomassin had remained relatively untouched by worsening violence and turmoil in Haiti. Residents described the chaotic scene early Monday.
Last night, around 11 p.m., as we were sitting here, two young boys suddenly appeared and opened fire on several of our brothers. They didn't address anyone. They just came up and started shooting. They didn't ask any questions. I was there when the shooting happened, and I saw them get out of a car and start shooting. I was trying to understand the situation.
Last week, unelected Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry announced he'll resign after a coalition of armed groups opposing his rule declared an uprising. Meanwhile, Haitian stakeholders and leaders of the Caribbean Community, or CARICOM, are still in negotiations to establish a transitional presidential council in Haiti. In Nigeria, armed groups kidnapped at least 100 people, including children, in two separate attacks in Kaduna State in the north. The mass abduction is the latest attack following the separate kidnapping of nearly 300 students and staff from a school in the northwestern town of Kuriga earlier this month. Abductions in Nigeria have become more frequent in recent years as armed groups target residents for large ransoms. In Gambia, the National Assembly voted to repeal a landmark 2015 ban on female genital cutting, also known as female genital mutilation. If approved, it would be the first reversal of protections against the practice, which causes long-term health effects, including increased risks of complications during pregnancy and childbirth. Less than 10% of the National Assembly's members are women. This is Amnesty International researcher Michelle Ekin.
It simply will be disastrous for women's rights, not only in Gambia, but in the region. It would tell young girls, you know, your rights can be easily taken away. If this is passed, then what's next? We have to really be strong about it and make sure that we don't take away something that took so long to fight for.
Schools in South Sudan have temporarily shuttered in preparation for a scorching heat wave that's expected to last for the next 2 weeks. Officials have advised children to stay indoors as temperatures are likely to reach 113 degrees Fahrenheit. Extreme heat waves have become more common in South Sudan due to the worsening climate crisis and has compounded an already dire humanitarian crisis due to conflict in the region. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has expressed concerns at reports the Burmese military is continuing to bomb civilian areas. Dozens of people were reportedly killed, including children, early Monday in Burmese military airstrikes on a predominantly Rohingya village in Rakhine State. Clashes in the region have soared after the end of a ceasefire in November between the Arakan Army and Burmese forces that have been in place since 2021 military coup. Guterres said, quote, "The expansion of conflict is driving displacement and exacerbating pre-existing vulnerabilities and discrimination." In Syria, some 30,000 children and women who had ties to Islamic State militants are still being detained in camps and prisons across North Syria under severely abusive conditions. That's according to a UN-backed commission, which says most of the children were brought to the camps a decade ago when the Islamic State controlled portions of land in the region. It's been 5 years since the militant group lost its presence in Syria, but the children have yet to be repatriated to their home countries, remaining in indefinite captivity. Tens of thousands of people, many of them children under the age of 12 and women who are married to Islamic State militants, are being held at Al-Hol camp, which has been described by the UN as a, quote, blight on the conscience of humanity. Dozens of babies are reportedly born each month at Al-Hol, which is located in a region of northwestern Syria still patrolled by hundreds of U.S. troops. Meanwhile, teenage boys are kept in jails that are run by the U.S.-backed, Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces. In Argentina, protesters in Buenos Aires were met with riot police and tear gas Monday as they marched in a union-led rally to protest mounting food insecurity and far-right President Javier Milei's massive cuts to social spending. This is union leader Hugo Godoy.
Today we came back to march together to demand the government once again respond to this worsening situation of the food crisis that over 6 million Argentinians suffer from. The government doesn't even have an inch of humanity to guarantee food provisions to soup kitchens. It's as if they enjoyed the people's pain.
The protest took place days after Argentine senators dealt a major blow to President Javier Milei's so-called economic shock therapy agenda, voting to block his sweeping decree. Since taking office, Milei has imposed over 300 austerity and deregulation measures. He also cracked down on the right to protest. Argentina has the highest inflation rate in the world, even as it slowed down to 13% last month, down from 20% in January. UNICEF's warned children are suffering some of the worst effects of the current economic crisis, and Milei's cost-cutting measures with a child poverty rate that could soon hit 70%. Back in the United States, Donald Trump's failed to secure the $454 million bond for his New York civil fraud case, increasing the likelihood New York Attorney General Letitia James will seize his real estate assets. Trump's lawyer said their client was turned down by around 30 bond underwriting companies. The lawyers are requesting the former president be allowed to delay posting bond while he appeals the case. If their request is denied, Letitia James could start seizing Trump's properties on Monday. In other Trump news, former White House aide Peter Navarro is expected to turn himself into a federal prison in Miami today to serve his four-month sentence for contempt of Congress. Navarro will become the first ever ex-White House official to serve time for a contempt of Congress conviction after he refused to comply with a subpoena from the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection. The U.S. Supreme Court Monday heard arguments in two First Amendment cases. The National Rifle Association's accusing a New York State official of threatening insurance companies in order to get them to cut ties with the NRA. In another case, conservative states and social media users allege the federal government overstepped when it put pressure on social media companies to moderate misinformation around COVID-19 and the 2020 election. The justices appeared skeptical of efforts to limit the Biden administration's contact with social media companies. This is Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson.
So I guess some might say that the government actually has a duty to take steps to protect the citizens of this country. And you seem to be suggesting that that duty cannot manifest itself in the government encouraging or even pressuring platforms to take down harmful information. So can you help me? Because I'm really worried about that, because you've got the First Amendment operating in an environment of threatening circumstances from the government's perspective. And you're saying that the government can't interact with the source of those problems.
And the Environmental Protection Agency announced a total ban on asbestos. The carcinogen had been largely prohibited in previous environmental orders, but chrysotile asbestos had been permitted until this latest ban and is used in a range of products, including brake linings, gaskets, and in chlorine bleach and sodium hydroxide production. It's been found to cause lung cancer, mesothelioma, and other cancers, and is linked to over 40,000 U.S. deaths each year. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Famine is imminent in northern Gaza. That's according to a UN-backed report published Monday. The latest findings say virtually everyone in Gaza is struggling to get enough food and that nearly a third of the population of 2.3 million people are experiencing the highest levels of catastrophic hunger. At least 27 people, mostly children, have died from malnutrition and dehydration in the north. According to the new report, the death rate's expected to accelerate and reach famine levels soon. The World Health Organization said in a statement, quote, "The IPC report confirms that we, our UN partners and NGOs, have been witnessing and reporting for months. When our missions reach hospitals, we meet exhausted and hungry health workers who ask us for food and water. We see patients trying to recover from life-saving surgeries and losses of limbs, or sick with cancer or diabetes, mothers who've just given birth or newborn babies all suffering from hunger and the diseases that stalk it," end quote. This comes as the Israeli military launched another major raid on Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City Monday, with Israeli forces backed by tanks and artillery surrounding the complex and troops storming into a number of buildings. The health ministry said about 30,000 people had been sheltering at the hospital, which is the largest hospital in Gaza, and that everyone who tries to move is targeted by sniper bullets and quadcopters, they said. Among those killed in the raid was Faik Abkhouh, a senior officer in the Gaza police who was in charge of coordinating aid distribution in the north. Meanwhile, President Biden warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a telephone call Monday that an invasion of Rafah would be a mistake and called on Netanyahu to send a team of officials to Washington to discuss an alternative approach to targeting Hamas and Rafah without a major ground invasion. Israel's continued to bomb Rafah almost daily, prompting the Palestinian Foreign Ministry to say Israel's already begun its large-scale attack on the area. The death toll in Gaza is close to 32,000, over a third of them children, while nearly 74,000 people have been injured. For more, we're joined by Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, Palestinian physician, activist, politician. He serves as general secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative. He's joining us from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Dr. Barghouti, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's talk about this issue of famine. Doctors describing the wasting that you see, for example, at the temples of people who are dying of starvation, particularly children. Can you talk about what this means and when these officials in the UN and other bodies talk about this man-made disaster?
Well, the reality is that the whole of Gaza population, 2.3 million people, are suffering from malnutrition already. That includes children, men, women, pregnant women, breastfeeding women, everybody. And that is because of the Israeli-imposed siege on Gaza, which is combined with continuous bombardment that is taking away the lives of people. But it is also combined with the fact that Israel has destroyed more than 70% of people's homes. They don't have normal place to be in. They don't have normal clothes. They don't have clean water to drink. And they don't have food supplies. And this is all happening in front of the world. We're talking about famine. We're talking about hunger. And we are talking about actually 700,000 people starving now in the north of Gaza. That includes also Gaza City, of whom 350,000 are children. And that's why I think almost 30 children have died because of starvation already. This is all happening because of the Israeli siege, because nobody in the world, not the United States, not Europe, not the international community as a whole, is capable of forcing Israel to stop this terrible crime of collective punishment against a whole population. And Israel will not change its policy and its approach without sanctions. The world should impose sanctions on Israel to force it to open the roads of supplies of humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza and to accept a ceasefire. Because even if supplies are there and the bombardment continues, people will survive to die. That is the reality of the situation. Today, 5% of the total population of Gaza have been killed or injured. We're talking about almost 120,000 people. If that had happened in the United States of America, you would be talking about almost 12 million people killed or injured in 5 months of this terrible war. So that is the reality of the situation. But add to that, malnutrition causes low immunity. Lack of water causes diseases. There is an outbreak of certain diseases like infectious hepatitis, which has already affected 10,000 people. We have 32 medical teams from our organization, Palestinian Medical Relief Society, working in Gaza, and they report horrible reports. About 1 million people at this very moment in Gaza are sick with respiratory diseases, with gastrointestinal infections, with diarrhea, with hepatitis. And our biggest worry is the outbreak of certain infections among children, because these children in Gaza have not had vaccination for more than 165 days.
Can you talk about, I think it's the fourth raid now on Al-Shifa, and they say tens of thousands of people that are taking refuge there. The Israeli military and spokespeople saying they're very careful. They have highly trained forces, that they separate the civilians from the militants. And them talking about a high-level Hamas official, Faik Mabou, killing him along with other fighters. Mabou, apparently, top food the person in charge of food distribution in the north.
First of all, the Israeli army is lying when they say that they differentiate between civilians and non-civilians. How can this explain the fact that more than 80% of the people who were killed are civilians, women and children mainly? How can they explain that 70% of everybody killed are children and women? They lie, and they lie around the clock. And each time they are caught with a crime that is obvious, like shooting the people who are starving in the north, trying to get some food from humanitarian aid, and they shot them. We're talking about 400 people shot while they were trying to get some flour. These people are totally civilians. They're not armed. They're not threat to anybody, but they killed them, in addition to injuring more than 3,000 other people. So they keep lying, and I don't believe their lies. Now, Mr. Mabhouh, who was killed, is a policeman. He's not a fighter. He's not from Qassam Brigade. He's not he's not carrying arms to fight. He was simply organizing some supplies to get to the north. And for the first time, 2 days ago, 13 trucks with some flour got to the north of Gaza. Clearly, and this was well organized, people received their portions. There were no gangs to steal this supply. And obviously, this is something that Israelis didn't like. They didn't like that people were organized and getting some supplies after so many days of hunger. And that's why they killed Mr. Mabhouh. They want chaos in Gaza. And their goal from attacking Shifa Hospital is actually to push people from Shifa Hospital and from Gaza City to the south again. Because the ultimate goal of Israel is ethnic cleansing. And the reality is that the whole operation, military operation to attack Rafah is already ready to be implemented, and maybe parts of it has already started to be implemented, as you mentioned. And there, why are they attacking Rafah with 1.4 million people there in an area that is very small? It does not exceed 25 square miles. They will cause a terrible massacre, but their real goal is to push people through the borders to Egypt, because Netanyahu did not change his original plan of ethnic cleansing. And the United States government, Mr. Biden and his administration, instead of saying to Netanyahu, you cannot have an operation in Rafah, and you have to stop this fight, and you have to accept ceasefire, instead of that, they are deciding to become part of his war cabinet, discussing the plans of how to attack Rafah, rather than saying that this attack should not take place.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan briefed reporters on this last call between Biden and Netanyahu. He laid out the concerns Biden expressed about that possible ground invasion of Rafah.
1st, more than 1 million people have taken refuge in Rafah. They went from Gaza City to Khan Yunis and then to Rafah. And they have nowhere else to go. Gaza's other major cities have largely been destroyed. And Israel has not presented us or the world with a plan for how or where they would safely move those civilians, let alone feed and house them and ensure access to basic things like sanitation. But a major ground operation there would be a mistake. It would lead to more innocent civilian deaths, worsen the already dire humanitarian crisis, deepen the anarchy in Gaza, and further isolate Israel internationally.
So if you can talk about what this team from the Israeli government is that's going to Washington, D.C. to come up with a so-called alternative plan, although Israel keeps insisting they don't kill Palestinian civilians. They have very targeted troops that know exactly the difference between them and what it means to say if they attack Rafah, which, of course, every day they are doing, but a full-scale ground invasion, they will establish humanitarian humanitarian islands for people to go to?
That's not true, because there is no safe place anymore in Gaza. And if there are places which will not be bombarded, as they claim, they are places without any infrastructure, without water, without electricity, without food, without medical services, without medicines, without anything. Where would people go? To talk about the possibility of such an attack that it would cause more harm is not enough. It will cause a huge massacre, the largest massacre in human history, probably, at least in the modern history. We will be talking about tens of thousands of people who will be slaughtered. That is the reality. And they have no place to escape to. Israel kept saying to people, move from this place to that place, it will be safe, and then they would bombard the safe space. So the United States should not say, I repeat, should not say there isn't a good plan. They should say that the whole attack should not happen and that this war must stop. And when the Israelis say they differentiate, they are lying. Are the 14,000 Palestinian children who were killed military activists or militants? These are children, for God's sake. And they are not 19 or 18 years old. These are 10 years old, 2 years old, 1 year old, even months old. That is the reality of what's happening in Gaza. It's a massacre. It's a huge genocide that Israel is engaging in. And the United States of America does not have the guts to go to the United Nations Security Council resolution and allow the passage of a resolution demanding immediate ceasefire. That's what we need, immediate ceasefire, no attack on Rafah, and supplies immediately to the civilian population of Gaza, which is starving.
And can you
any other thing?
Can you talk
any other thing? Just talk, yeah. Please.
About the negotiations that are going on in Qatar right now. Talk about what Hamas has put forward.
Hamas tried, the reports show that Hamas tried to be flexible. They made some concessions to make it possible to reach an agreement because they are really worried about the humanitarian situation of the people and the so many people who have been killed. But unfortunately, Netanyahu restricted the team that went to Qatar. He restricted their authority and authorization. And in my frank opinion, I think Netanyahu he made all these restrictions with his team to prevent reaching an agreement and then use that failure to justify an attack on Rafah. I do not think, because Netanyahu knows if he goes into a deal with Hamas about release of some prisoners and exchange of prisoners, his coalition partners, the fascists, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, will bring his government down. So all he thinks about is how to save himself, how to save his position. He doesn't care about Israeli prisoners. He knows very well that if he attacks Rafah, so many Israeli prisoners will be killed. He knows that, but he doesn't care about them. And he is stuck with these fascists in his government, and he's driving his whole government into the direction, and actually the Israeli society at large, is driving them into the direction of fascism because what's happening in Palestine cannot be made with, except by people who have no respect whatsoever, not only to international law, but to human lives in general.
You're in the occupied West Bank, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. You're in Ramallah. Can you talk about the arrests of journalists? You have Ismail Al-Ghul. He's with Al Jazeera Arabic, stripped naked there for hours, detained, interrogated with others when they raided Al-Shifa Hospital. Al Jazeera reported that satellite trucks were attacked outside. That's TV satellite trucks to restrict further images. You have in the occupied West Bank, Rula Hassanein, who is a Palestinian journalist. It's unclear if she was in taken from her home in Ramallah or was at Bethlehem at like 2 in the morning, has a 9-month-old baby, is breastfeeding. This just happened. The attack on journalists, and what do you think is the message Israel is sending?
The message is that they are reoccupying all of the West Bank and all of Gaza, subjecting all Palestinian people without exception to terrible oppression. And as you know, Amy, since the beginning of this war, Israel did not allow any foreign journalist to enter Gaza, except for one from CNN who was allowed there only for 3 hours. They didn't allow any foreign journalist in, and then they started executing the local journalists. Up to now, 146 Palestinian journalists in Gaza were killed by Israeli snipers or Israeli bombardment, including two from Al Jazeera network. And now they've arrested the third one, Al-Ghul, before, and practically tortured him before releasing him. And you remember the story of the family of Dahdouh, who lost his wife, his children, and because he was reporting for Al Jazeera. And in my opinion, the attacks on journalists are also taking place in the West Bank. More than 30 journalists were arrested so far, and it goes on. And in the West Bank, by the way, Israel has arrested more than 7,500 new people. The total number of people in Israeli jails in the West Bank has risen from 5,300 to almost 9,000. And one thing that the world doesn't talk about is the terrible torture that the people in Israeli prisons are subjected to. They are fighting them, torturing them with hunger. They brought down the rations for their food rations by 70%. They beat them regularly. Most recently, they attacked even one of the political prisoners, Marwan Barghouti, and many of his colleagues as well, beating them badly. And it goes on. We have lost already 13 people in Israeli jails because of torture and because of beating and because of starvation. The situation in Israeli prisons is horrifying. And in Gaza, we don't know exactly the number of people who were imprisoned or kidnapped. We're talking about thousands of people, maybe 3,000, maybe 4,000. But the people who were released told us horrible stories about how they were tortured in an Israeli concentration camp in the Negev with electrical shocks, with drowning them in the water, with terrible beating. The director of Shifa Hospital is still imprisoned. They broke both of his hands, as was reported, and they tried to force him to admit things that he never did. That is the reality and the situation on the ground. It's horrifying.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, I want to thank you for being with us. Palestinian physician, activist, politician, serves as general secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative, speaking to us from his office in the occupied West Bank in Ramallah. Next up, we talk about Haiti. As violence continues, we speak with the former U.S. Special Envoy for Haiti, Ambassador Dan Foote, who resigned in 2021, citing the Biden administration's what he called inhumane treatment of Haitian asylum seekers and U.S. meddling in Haitian politics. Back in 20 seconds. في نص الليل عملية في البيت في الأقصى عمعتها لو بكفر أصلي تدين جيب جيش فوت على الحرب اتغلب مقنابل الصوت بالتخبة تقلب أنا شاب متكتك أصلي مرتب صوت
ضوضاء زي حفلة في نص الليل عملية في البيت في الأقصى عمحتها لو بكفر أصل تدين جيب جيش فوت على الحرب تغلب مقنابل الصوت بالتخ بتقلب أنا شاب متكتك أصل مرتب ببلاط ببلاط عب السما طلاق تنسيق تدخل على كفر عقاب بدك جيش تفوت على مخيم نحكيش أسماء إذا حدا طلاق
The tak-tak, which means good etiquette by Shab Jadid and Al Nather. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Haiti, at least 12 people have been killed as armed groups attack Pétionville, an upscale area in the capital Port-au-Prince, Monday. Amid the worsening violence and turmoil, Haiti's power company announced four substations have been destroyed, leaving swaths of the capital without electricity. Last week, unelected Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry announced he'll resign after a coalition of armed groups opposing the de facto leader declared an uprising. Haitian stakeholders and leaders of CARICOM, the Caribbean community, are still in negotiations to establish a transitional presidential council in Haiti. This comes as a U.S. government chartered flight carrying over 30 U.S. citizens, Haitian Americans, landed Sunday in Miami. Meanwhile, a boat carrying 25 migrants from Haiti was intercepted by Florida officials and turned over to the Coast Guard for deportation. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has deployed soldiers from National Guard to block Haitians from reaching Florida. The Biden administration is also reportedly considering housing any influx of Haitians to Guantanamo Bay. For more, we're joined by Ambassador Dan Foote. He is the former U.S. Special Envoy for Haiti, resigned from his post in September 2021, citing the Biden administration's inhumane treatment of Haitian asylum seekers and U.S. meddling in Haitian politics. Joining us now from Buffalo, New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ambassador Foote. Can you talk about what's happening right now in Haiti?
Yeah, it's complete anarchy and chaos. Haiti's been broken since the assassination of the president 32 months ago. But by anointing Ariel Henry, the United States and the international community put a hated party back in power in Haiti, the party that the Haitians consider responsible for where they are right now. And as a result, 32 months has gone by. Haiti has eroded by a magnitude of 5 or 10 times in that period. And it's just chaos on the street. And currently, we're holding Haiti hostage through this CARICOM political process. We wasted going on 3 weeks now since this current crisis started. I think that's a signal that the Haitian people probably don't want the CARICOM solution.
I want to turn to a clip of former U.S. Ambassador to Haiti, Pamela White, speaking to Fox News over the weekend.
I talked to Guy Philippe yesterday, and I know that he's sort of put as being one of the bad boys, but in my opinion, he's someone that can help with the situation, and I believe we should be dealing with him. We dealt with the Duvaliers for 20-plus years. We can certainly deal with Guy Philippe. He's charismatic, he's bright, he's articulate, and he has many, many people that are following him, and I think he can be part of the solution. I think that even Barbecue, Jimmy C, can be part of the solution. I don't think that 1,000 Kenyan troops for the tune of $237 million are going to turn the situation around in Haiti. And my last really important point is this new seven-person council, transition council. I don't know transition to what, because we're in a total failed state in Haiti. But in any case, if one of the people that are appointed on that seven-person council are the elite, the names that we have heard, the political elite, the private sector elite, even one, the people that have mansions in the hills of Port-au-Prince, Pétionville and above, the people who have mansions in Florida and send their kids to Ivy League schools, those people, if there's even one, it's going to fail.
So that's former U.S. Ambassador to Haiti, Pamela White, from 2012 to 2015, speaking to Fox News. This is quite amazing that she's talking about Guy Philippe. Guy Philippe, who was one of the leaders of the coup that overthrew the democratically elected president Jean-Bertrand Aristide, supported by the George W. Bush, supported by the Bush administration. And then you had the fact that he served years in jail, in a U.S. jail for drug trafficking, just released in November. It reminds us of Joe, of Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was just convicted of drug trafficking, the former U.S.-supported president of Honduras. And she is saying he should be considered. He did come out of prison and say he wants to be the president of Haiti. Is this possible that the U.S. is pushing for him to be a part of the solution?
There certainly is some ironic timing going on. I don't think the U.S. is that foolish, but they've made a lot of poor judgment errors in Haiti in the past 3 years, so anything is possible. They just released Guy Philippe a matter of months ago after he completed a seven-year stint in federal prison for money laundering. They couldn't get him on drug trafficking, or they would have, or he would have done 30 years, and they sent him back there. Now, Guy Philippe has a little bit of a constituency in Haiti. He's not an unknown, but the Haitians are not looking to be governed by criminals, and the Haitian people have to make these decisions. This is a great example of Americans, foreigners, non-black Haitians. Everybody has an answer for Haiti. Unfortunately, historically, none of those answers have worked. And throwing gangbangers into the middle of this is not going to work. There's a voice to a certain extent that the gangs have gained in the past 30 months. And they're going to have to cooperate in a Haitian dialogue, and I think they will. But the Haitian people have no room for criminals in their leadership in the future. They've had criminal leaders with impunity because of their backing from the international community for the past many years, generations.
Ambassador Foote, what about people who are fleeing Haiti? Explain why you quit in 2021.
Two reasons. The main reason was the anointment and support of Ariel Henry. It was clear to me that was not going to work. And at the time the U.S. was propping him up, there was a parallel discussion going on in Haiti, civil society and opposition political parties looking to come together with a consensus political agreement. And that was, in my opinion, and still is, the way forward for Haiti. Then you had the terrible situation in Del Rio, Texas, where you had CBP guys whipping Haitian refugees up there. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back for my resignation.
You talked about the inhumane treatment the Biden administration in returning, deporting Haitians into a very dangerous situation.
I did. Let's look at this. We, for years, have told all Americans, don't travel to Haiti. It's too dangerous. If the balloon goes up, we might not be able to help you. And we're seeing right now that that's going on. You have over 1,000 Americans trying to get out of Haiti right now, and the U.S. government is not assisting them at all. Everyone in Haiti is going to look to leave that island, as you and I would right now if we were there. It's not livable. And famine and violence and a complete breakdown of society is something that any cogent human being would try to flee. The idea that we can just use Guantanamo as a staging area is kind of crazy. We've done it before. Haiti's a failed state. It can't support the people that live there right now. We have taken all of our people and gotten them out. What kind of humanity exists when we're then picking up desperate Haitians and forcing them back into this catastrophe?
The idea of Haiti, the history of the U.S. Being repeated in Haiti. The U.S. put Haitians with HIV at Guantanamo until the outcry was so great and lawsuits they were dealing with was too much. And that ended. But the idea of putting them back into this prison camp, If you can talk about what it means that this is an election year for President Biden and Haitians fleeing the violence of Haiti, going to Florida is also a repeat of history. U.S. involvement leading to Haitian refugees. They land in Florida and Democrats are afraid of Florida flipping. What do you think should happen? You have the Senator of Massachusetts, the Congress member from Massachusetts as well, Ayanna Pressley, demanding that Haitians not be deported as late as last week. And yet we see returns, for example, forcing the return of Haitian migrants at sea.
So, first of all, let me touch on this. Haitians right now are kind of beside themselves. They're like, the U.S. kind of used to be our friend and our partner. Why are they doing this to us? And the fact that we're trying to impose another flawed government on the Haitian people and ask them all to stay there and not going anywhere is unfathomable to these poor people. They've asked me, what's next? Are you going to build a cage around Haiti? So let's turn to immigration. The Biden administration in 21, after the assassination, treated Haiti not as hemispheric and global leaders, but as somebody just trying to sweep something under the rug for domestic politics and hoping that it wouldn't blow up. And now their worst nightmare has occurred here a few months before the elections. And as Haitians and I have been predicted the whole time, it has now completely come unspooled. And the Biden administration is flailing. The idea that you can scoop up every Haitian that's fleeing Haiti on these unseaworthy boats is a dangerous concept. I'm concerned for our own Coast Guard folks boarding and seizing and taking migrants into custody is a very dangerous thing, particularly in the seas between Haiti and Florida, which are quite rough. And you're taking a lot of risk on our own security officials in doing this. But at the end of the day, what are we accomplishing in doing this other than telling Haitians not to come here? Our economy was on the verge of a terrible recession a year ago. That never occurred, and nobody's ever asked why. If you look and ask economists, it's because the huge migrant influx has prevented that, because we need that labor. And the fact that we can just keep out desperate people from Haiti is a concept, but not a reality. You can close the border, as the Biden administration has talked about doing, but I live right across from the border with Canada, and there's no way that we can stop people from coming across our enormous borders if we try.
Ambassador Danforth, I want to thank you for being with us. Former U.S. Special Envoy for Haiti resigned his post in 2021 over what he called the Biden administration's inhumane treatment of Haitian asylum seekers. Next up, as Donald Trump once again escalates attacks on migrants, talking about them as animals, we'll see a film that, to say the least, changes the narrative. It's called Unseen, profiling a blind, undocumented social work student named Pedro. Back in 20 seconds.
One of these days, I'll sit you down and I'll tell you all about this dream of mine. But at the moment, I'm not sure how to put it in words. I stumble and crash in the dark of my mind. They chase me away.
Round and Around, a new song by Julie Yoon Kim, featured in Unseen, a new film that we'll talk about next. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. On the campaign trail, Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump's escalating his attacks on migrants.
Years, if you call them people, I don't know if you call them people. In some cases, they're not people, in my opinion, but I'm not allowed to say that because the radical left says that's a terrible thing to say. They say you have to vote against him because did you hear what he said about humanity? I've seen the humanity, and these humanity, these are bad. These are animals, okay?
These are not people. These are animals. Trump's also touted fake news about crime rates by undocumented immigrants, even though studies show U.S.-born residents are much more likely to commit crimes than undocumented immigrants, including violent crimes. Meanwhile, President Biden said he regrets using the word illegal during a State of the Union address to describe a Venezuelan immigrant accused of killing a Georgia nursing student, Laken Riley. Biden will campaign in the battleground border states of Arizona and Nevada today. Well, a new film hopes to reframe the narrative entirely. It premiered Monday night on the PBS documentary series POV called Unseen. Profiles a blind, undocumented social work student named Pedro. The film's accessible for blind and low vision audiences. This is the trailer.
Keep going, Tyler.
The bus is coming.
Oh, cool. Yes.
Nice.
A service animal.
Does a service do your dog do?
He's a guide dog.
Oh, okay. So you're blind now?
Uh-huh.
Well, you want me to describe myself to you?
Sure, why not?
Yeah. Oh, I'm so cute. Got a nice smile.
After you have a disability, you're going to have some type of impediment. But the intersectionality between being undocumented and having a disability, it plays a lot of stress and anxiety into you. I decided to study social work. I wanted to help people. I wanted to give an opportunity for those that they didn't have an opportunity. On our path, there are going to be some obstacles. So I want you to go swipe left and right, cover from shoulder to shoulder, just to see if we can find out obstacles. I hate that narrative of like the good immigrant, especially when it's like, hey, he's blind, he's undocumented, or he's going to college. Oh, he must be a saint. I'm here. I was able to make it this far, but how many people have to sacrifice for me to get a chance?
The trailer for Unseen. We're joined now in Los Angeles by its director, Seth Hernandez. Welcome to Democracy Now! Congratulations on this amazing film. If you can talk about your journey making it with your friend Pedro, and I mean, just the title Unseen, of course, invoking undocumented and immigrants, as well as Pedro's sight challenges, and even the framing, the way you make it out of focus for us all to try to see what Pedro sees.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy. I've been a big fan of the show and truly grateful for the journalism that you all do at Democracy Now! Unseen really started with me meeting Pedro years ago at a program for undocumented young adults. And I feel like with the film, to your point about the title, while the film kind of uplifts the experiences of undocumented and disability through Pedro, I think at the end of the day, the film is also about vulnerability. Because often the discourse about immigration, as you just played the clips, you know, with Donald Trump, it's often kind of coming from this place of the political, the election. And I think for me as an undocumented immigrant myself also, I'm really interested in how can we amplify and uplift the internal and inherent humanity of undocumented folks. And I think at the end of the day, when people watch the film, they're able to connect with the vulnerability that Pedro portrays and that inherent humanity that we uplift from the undocumented and disabled perspective is really what's at the heart of this project.
You begin with Pedro and his dog as a dog lover, but how touching it is, this team that makes their way, navigates life. And, you know, what Pedro is doing as a social work student, working with those who are challenged, particularly blind, also dealing with one of the worst massacres in U.S. history in Las Vegas, particularly focusing on Latino victims?
I think so much of the film really uplifts the intersectionalities, because when we think about immigration, I feel like the discourse in this country only just focus on immigrants as immigrants. And through Pedro, we are really uplifting how the different intersectionalities of our experience, in Pedro's case, being an undocumented immigrant who also has disability, and also mental health, and how so much of the conversations of fear-mongering, to be honest, even, that our communities experience impacts the way we think about our future and uncertainty. And I think with the film, we really are uplifting the experience of interdependence and how we as a community can continue to lean on each other, which Pedro and his community, through Tyler, his guide dog, his family, his mentors, his teachers, are really showcasing, because it's so difficult to just rely on the state for so many of us, and really claiming ownership over our lives in this way.
Talk about the challenges. I want to go to another clip from Unseen. When you, Set, you're the director, you reunite with Pedro.
Pedro, it's been a few years since we've last spoken. How have you been?
My grandma passed in 2018. And that created the trauma to me. She was already feeling sick 2 weeks prior to her passing. Instead of slowing down, prioritize my family over anything else, I decided to go to school on a Sunday to study, to prepare for a final. And I wasn't there. And a semester later, I got my master's. That made me wonder what I was doing with my life. Is it because I really wanted to? Was it because it was being imposed to me? Or simply, I was just trying to survive? Many times I thought about just going to sleep and never wake up again. I was aware that if I ever did something like that, I was gonna destroy my mom and my dad. So I didn't have the heart to do something like that.
Talk about how this is also a film about healing, Set. And in some ways, it's about you as well. Part of the 7-year journey you go on making this film, you co-founded out of necessity the Undocumented Filmmakers Collective, which promotes equity for undocumented immigrants in the film industry.
Yes, you know, I want to lift up a quote from Ursula Le Guin. She says, "Hard times are coming. When we'll be wanting the voices of writers who can see alternatives to how we live now. We'll need writers who can remember freedom, poets, visionaries, realists of a larger reality." I feel like in the discourse about immigration, so often it's the politicians whose voices and perspectives are uplifted. And with Unseen, what I'm really proud of is our filmmaking team is reflective of Pedro's life. Our film was led by a team of filmmakers who happen to be undocumented immigrants ourselves. Blind and disabled artists have also been an integral part of our filmmaking practice. And I feel like, how can we reclaim the narrative for ourselves instead of further uplifting the perspectives that politicians have about our community? How can we really lean on each other and amplify the voices and the ways that we understand our lives and the world? And I feel like because of the way that the film industry works, undocumented people, systems impacted people, people with disabilities are excluded from receiving resources to be able to make films. Because even for me to be able to make the film, I was excluded from so many grant-making opportunities because of citizenship and residency requirements that so many of these opportunities require. So
Seth,
we're really
Hernandez,
grateful for all the people that have supported
us. I want
to
thank you for being with us and congratulate you on Unseen, which just premiered on POV. You can now watch it online. We're going to do part two at democracynow.org. Unseen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.